possess immense privileges, upon which their pride rests, without seeking to rely upon the lesser advantages which accrue to them. As these privileges came to them by inheritance, they regard them in some sort as a portion of themselves, or at least as a natural right inherent in their own persons. They therefore entertain a calm sense of their superiority. They do not dream of vaunting privileges which everyone perceives and no one contests, and these things are not sufficiently new to them to be made topics of conversation. They stand unmoved in their solitary greatness, well assured that they are seen of all the world without any effort to show themselves off, and that no one will attempt to drive them from that position. When an aristocracy carries on the public affairs, its national pride naturally assumes this reserved, indifferent, and haughty form, which is imitated by all the other classes of the nation. When, on the contrary, social conditions differ but little, the slightest privileges are of some importance. As every man sees around himself a million of people enjoying precisely similar or analogous advantages, his pride becomes craving and jealous. He clings to mere trifles and doggedly defends them. In democracies, as the conditions of life are very fluctuating, men have almost always recently acquired the advantages which they possess. The consequence is that they feel extreme pleasure in exhibiting them, to show others and convince themselves that they really enjoy them. As at any instant these same advantages may be lost, their possessors are constantly on the alert and make a point of showing that they still retain them. Men living in democracies love their country just as they love themselves, and they transfer the habits of their private vanity to their vanity as a nation. The restless and insatiable vanity of a democratic people originates so entirely in the equality and precariousness of social conditions that the members of the haughtiest nobility display the very same passion in those lesser portions of their existence in which there is anything fluctuating or contested. An aristocratic class always differs greatly from the other classes of a nation by the extent and perpetuity of its privileges. But it often happens that the only differences between the members who belong to it consist in small transient advantages which may any day be lost or acquired. The members of a powerful aristocracy collected in a capital or a court have been known to contest with virulence those frivolous privileges which depend on the caprice of fashion or the will of their master. These persons then displayed towards each other precisely the same puerile jealousies which animate the men of democracies, the same eagerness to snatch the smallest advantages which their equals contested, and the same desire to parade ostentatiously those of which they were in possession. If national pride ever entered into the minds of courtiers, I do not question that they would display it in the same manner as the members of a democratic community. Chapter 17. That the aspect of society in the United States is at once excited and monotonous. It would seem that nothing can be more adapted to stimulate and to feed curiosity than the aspect of the United States. Fortunes, opinions, and laws are there in ceaseless variation. It is as if immutable nature herself were mutable. Such are the changes worked upon her by the hand of man. Yet in the end, the sight of this excited community becomes monotonous, and after having watched the moving pageant for a time, the spectator is tired of it. Amongst aristocratic nations, every man is pretty nearly stationary in his own sphere. But men are astonishingly unlike each other. Their passions, their notions, their habits, and their tastes are essentially different. Nothing changes, but everything differs. In democracies, on the contrary, all men are alike and do things pretty much nearly alike. It is true that they are subject to great and frequent vicissitudes, but as the same events of good or adverse fortune are continually recurring, the name of the actors only is changed. The piece is always the same. The aspect of American society is animated because men and things are always changing, but it is monotonous because all these changes are alike. Men living in democratic ages have many passions, but most of their passions either end in the love of riches or proceed from it. The cause of this is not that their souls are narrower, but that the importance of money is really greater at such times. When all the members of a community are independent of or indifferent to each other, the cooperation of each of them can only be obtained by paying for it. This infinitely multiplies the purposes to which wealth may be applied and increases its value. When the reverence which belonged to what is old has vanished, birth, condition, and profession no longer distinguish men, or scarcely distinguish them at all. Hardly anything but money remains to create strongly marked differences between them and to raise some of them above the common level. The distinction originating in wealth is increased by the disappearance and diminution of all other distinctions. Amongst aristocratic nations, money only reaches to a few points on the vast circle of man's desires. In democracies, it seems to lead to all. The love of wealth is therefore to be traced, either as a principal or as an accessory motive, at the bottom of all that the Americans do. This gives to all their passions a sort of family likeness, and soon renders the survey of them exceedingly wearisome. This perpetual recurrence of the same passion is monotonous. The peculiar methods by which this passion seeks its own gratification are no less so. In an orderly and constituted democracy like the United States, where men cannot enrich themselves by war, by public office, or by political confiscation, the love of wealth mainly drives them into business and manufactures. Although these pursuits often bring about great commotions and disasters, they cannot prosper without strictly regular habits and a long routine of petty uniform acts. The stronger the passion is, the more regular are these habits, and the more uniform are these acts. It may be said that it is the vehemence of their desires which makes the Americans so methodical. It perturbs their minds, but it disciplines their lives. The remark I here apply to America may indeed be addressed to almost all our contemporaries. Variety is disappearing from the human race. The same ways of acting, thinking, and feeling are to be met with all over the world. This is not only because nations work more upon each other and are more faithful in their mutual imitation, but as the men of each country relinquish more and more the peculiar opinions and feelings of a caste, a profession, or a family, they simultaneously arrive at something nearer to the constitution of man, which is everywhere the same. Thus, they become more alike, even without having imitated each other. Like travelers scattered about some large wood which is intersected by paths converging to one point, if all of them keep their eyes fixed upon that point and advance towards it, they insensibly draw nearer together, though they seek not, though they see not, though they know not each other. And they will be surprised at length to find themselves all collected on the same spot. All the nations which take, not any particular man, but man himself, as the object of their researches and their imitations, are tending in the end to a similar state of society, like these travelers converging to the central plot of the forest. Chapter 18. Of Honor in the United States and in Democratic Communities. It would seem that men employ two very distinct methods in the public estimation of the actions of their fellow men. At one time, they judge them by those simple notions of right and wrong which are diffused all over the world. At another, they refer their decision to a very few special notions which belong exclusively to some particular age and country. It often happens that these two rules differ. They sometimes conflict, but they are never either entirely identified or entirely annulled by one another. Author's note: the word honor is not always used in the same sense either in French or English. 1. It first signifies the dignity, glory, or reverence which a man receives from his kind, and in this sense a man is said to acquire honor. 2. Honor signifies the aggregate of those rules by the assistance of which his dignity, glory, and reverence is obtained. Thus we say that a man has always strictly obeyed the laws of honor, or a man has violated his honor. In this chapter, the word is always used in the latter sense. Honor, at the periods of its greatest power, sways the will more than the belief of men. And even whilst they yield without hesitation and without a murmur to its dictates, they feel notwithstanding, by a dim but mighty instinct, the existence of a more general, more ancient, and more holy law, which they sometimes disobey, although they cease not to acknowledge it. Some actions have been held to be at the same time virtuous and dishonorable. A refusal to fight a duel is a case in point. I think these peculiarities may be otherwise explained than by the mere caprices of certain individuals and nations, and has hitherto been the customary mode of reasoning on the subject. Mankind is subject to general and lasting wants that have engendered moral laws, to the neglect of which men have ever and in all places attached the notion of censure and shame. To infringe them was to do ill. To do well was to conform to them. Within the bosom of this vast association of the human race, lesser associations have been formed which are called nations. And amidst these nations, further subdivisions have assumed the names of classes or castes. Each of these associations forms, as it were, a separate species of the human race. And though it has no essential difference from the mass of mankind, to a certain extent it stands apart and has certain wants peculiar to itself. To these special wants must be attributed the modifications which affect in various degrees and in different countries the mode of considering human actions, and the estimate which ought to be formed of them. It is the general and permanent interest of mankind that men should not kill each other, but it may happen to be the peculiar and temporary interest of a people or a class to justify, or even to honor, homicide. Honor is therefore that peculiar rule founded upon a peculiar state of society, by the application of which a people or a class allot praise or blame. Nothing is more unproductive to the mind than an abstract idea. I therefore hasten to call in the aid of facts and examples to illustrate my meaning. I select the most extraordinary kind of honor which was ever known in the world, and that which we are best acquainted with, namely, aristocratic honor springing out of feudal society. I shall explain it by means of the principle already laid down, and I shall explain the principle by means of the illustration. I am not here led to inquire when and how the aristocracy of the Middle Ages came into existence, why it was so deeply severed from the remainder of the nation, or what founded and consolidated its power. I take its existence as an established fact, and I am endeavoring to account for the peculiar view which it took of the greater part of human actions. The first thing that strikes me is that in the feudal world, actions were not always praised or blamed with reference to their intrinsic worth, but that they were sometimes appreciated exclusively with reference to the person who was the actor or the object of them, which is repugnant to the general conscience of mankind. Thus, some of the actions which were indifferent on the part of a man in humble life dishonored a noble. Others changed their whole character according as the person aggrieved by them belonged or did not belong to the aristocracy. When these different notions first arose, the nobility formed a distinct body amidst the people, which it commanded from the inaccessible heights where it was ensconced. To maintain this peculiar position, which constituted its strength, it not only required political privileges, but it required a standard of right and wrong for its own special use. That some particular virtue or vice belonged to the nobility rather than to the humble classes, that certain actions were guiltless when they affected the villain, which were criminal when they touched the noble. These were often arbitrary matters. But that honor or shame would be attached to a man's actions according to his condition was a result of the internal constitution of an aristocratic community. This has been actually the case in all the countries which have had an aristocracy. As long as a trace of the principle remains, these peculiarities will still exist. To debauch a woman of color scarcely injures the reputation of an American. To marry her dishonors him. In some cases, feudal honor enjoined revenge and stigmatized the forgiveness of insults. In others, it imperiously commanded men to conquer their own passions and imposed forgetfulness of self. It did not make humanity or kindness its law, but it extolled generosity. It set more store on liberality than on benevolence. It allowed men to enrich themselves by gambling or by war, but not by labor. It preferred great crimes to small earnings. Cupidity was less distasteful to it than avarice. Violence it often sanctioned, but cunning and treachery it invariably reprobated as contemptible. These fantastical notions did not proceed exclusively from the caprices of those who entertained them. a class which has succeeded in placing itself at the head of and above all others, and which makes perpetual exertions to maintain this lofty position, must especially honor those virtues which are conspicuous for their dignity and splendor, and which may be easily combined with pride and the love of power. Such men would not hesitate to invert the natural order of the conscience in order to give those virtues precedence before all others. It may even be conceived that some of the more bold and brilliant vices would readily be set above the quiet, unpretending virtues. The very existence of such a class in society renders these things unavoidable. The nobles of the Middle Ages placed military courage foremost amongst virtues, and in lieu of many of them. This was again a peculiar opinion which arose necessarily from the peculiarity of the state of society. Feudal aristocracy existed by war and for war. Its power had been founded by arms, and by arms that power was maintained. It therefore required nothing more than military courage, and that quality was naturally exalted above all others. Whatever denoted it, even at the expense of reason and humanity, was therefore approved and frequently enjoined by the manners of the time. Such was the main principle. The caprice of man was only to be traced in minuter details. That a man should regard a tap on the cheek as an unbearable insult, and should be obliged to kill in single combat the person who struck him thus lightly, is an arbitrary rule. But that a noble could not tranquilly receive an insult, and was dishonored if he allowed himself to take a blow without fighting, were direct consequences of the fundamental principles and the wants of military aristocracy. Thus it was true, to a certain extent, to assert that the laws of honor were capricious, but these caprices of honor were always confined within certain necessary limits. The peculiar rule, which was called honor by our forefathers, is so far from being an arbitrary law in my eyes, that I would readily engage to ascribe its most incoherent and fantastical injunctions to a small number of fixed and invariable wants inherent in feudal society. If I were to trace the notion of feudal honor to the domain of politics, I should not find it more difficult to explain its dictates. The state of society and the political institutions of the Middle Ages were such that the supreme power of the nation never governed the community directly. That power did not exist in the eyes of the people. Every man looked up to a certain individual whom he was bound to obey. By that intermediate personage, he was connected with all others. Thus, in feudal society, the whole system of the commonwealth rested upon the sentiment of fidelity to the person of the lord. To destroy that sentiment was to open the sluices of anarchy. Fidelity to a political superior was, moreover, a sentiment of which all the members of the aristocracy had constant opportunities of estimating the importance. For every one of them was a vassal as well as a lord, and had to command as well as to obey. To remain faithful to the lord, to sacrifice oneself for him if called upon, to share his good or evil fortunes, to stand by him in his undertakings, whatever they might be. Such were the first injunctions of feudal honor in relation to the political institutions of those times. The treachery of a vassal was branded with extraordinary severity by public opinion, and a name of peculiar infamy was invented for the offense which was called felony. On the contrary, few traces are to be found in the Middle Ages of the passion which constituted the life of the nations of antiquity. I mean patriotism. The word itself is of not very ancient date in the language. Author's note: even the word patrie was not used by the French writers until the 16th century. Feudal institutions concealed the country at large from men's sight and rendered the love of it less necessary. The nation was forgotten in the passions which attached men to persons. Hence it was no part of the strict law of feudal honor to remain faithful to one's country. Not indeed that the love of their country did not exist in the hearts of our forefathers, but it constituted a dim and feeble instinct, which has grown more clear and strong in proportion as aristocratic classes have been abolished and the supreme power of the nation centralized. This may be clearly seen from the contrary judgments which European nations have passed upon the various events of their histories, according to the generations by which such judgments have been formed. The circumstance which most dishonored the Constable de Bourbon in the eyes of his contemporaries was that he bore arms against his king. That which most dishonors him in our eyes is that he made war against his country. We brand him as deeply as our forefathers did, but for different reasons. I have chosen the honor of feudal times by way of illustration of my meaning, because its characteristics are more distinctly marked and more familiar to us than those of any other period. But I might have taken an example elsewhere, and I should have reached the same conclusion by a different road. Although we are less perfectly acquainted with the Romans than with our own ancestors, yet we know that certain peculiar notions of glory and disgrace obtained amongst them, which were not solely derived from the general principles of right and wrong. Many human actions were judged differently, according as they affected a Roman citizen or a stranger, a freeman or a slave. Certain vices were blazoned abroad, certain virtues were extolled above all others. In that age, says Plutarch in the Life of Coriolanus, martial prowess was more honored and prized in Rome than all the other virtues, insomuch that it was called virtus, the name of virtue itself, by applying the name of the kind to this particular species, so that virtue in Latin was as much as to say valor. Can anyone fail to recognize the peculiar want of that singular community which was formed for the conquest of the world? Any nation would furnish us with similar grounds of observation. For, as I have already remarked, whenever men collect together as a distinct community, the notion of honor instantly grows up amongst them. That is to say, a system of opinions peculiar to themselves as to what is blamable or commendable. And these peculiar rules always originate in the special habits and special interests of a community. This is applicable to a certain extent to democratic communities as well as to others, as we shall now proceed to prove by the example of the Americans. Author's note: I speak here of the Americans inhabiting those states where slavery does not exist. They alone can be said to present a complete picture of democratic society. Some loose notions of the old aristocratic honor of Europe are still to be found scattered amongst the opinions of the Americans. But these traditional opinions are few in number. They have but little root in the country, and but little power. They are like a religion which has still some temples left standing, though men have ceased to believe in it. But amidst these half-obliterated notions of exotic honor, some new opinions have sprung up, which constitute what may be termed in our days American honor. I have shown how the Americans are constantly driven to engage in commerce and industry. Their origin, their social condition, their political institutions, and even the spot they inhabit urge them irresistibly in this direction. Their present condition is then that of an almost exclusively manufacturing and commercial association, placed in the midst of a new and boundless country, which their principal object is to explore for purposes of profit. This is the characteristic which most peculiarly distinguishes the American people from all others at the present time. All those quiet virtues which tend to give a regular movement to the community and to encourage business will therefore be held in peculiar honor by that people, and to neglect those virtues will be to incur public contempt. All the more turbulent virtues, which often dazzle but more frequently disturb society, will on the contrary occupy a subordinate rank in the estimation of the same people. They may be neglected without forfeiting the esteem of the community. To acquire them would perhaps be to run a risk of losing it. The Americans make no less arbitrary classification of men's vices. There are certain propensities which appear censurable to the general reason and the universal conscience of mankind, but which happen to agree with the peculiar and temporary wants of the American community. These propensities are lightly reproved, sometimes even encouraged. For instance, the love of wealth and the secondary propensities connected with it may be more particularly cited. To clear, to till, and to transform the vast uninhabited continent which is his domain, the American requires the daily support of an energetic passion. That passion can only be the love of wealth. The passion for wealth is therefore not reprobated in America, and provided it does not go beyond the bounds assigned to it for public security, it is held in honor. The American lauds as a noble and praiseworthy ambition what our own forefathers in the Middle Ages stigmatized as servile cupidity, just as he treats as a blind and barbarous frenzy that ardor of conquest and martial temper which bore them to battle. In the United States, fortunes are lost and regained without difficulty. The country is boundless, and its resources inexhaustible. The people have all the wants and cravings of a growing creature, and whatever be their efforts, they are always surrounded by more than they can appropriate. This is not the ruin of a few individuals which may be soon repaired, but the inactivity and sloth of the community at large which would be fatal to such a people. Boldness of enterprise is the foremost cause of its rapid progress, its strength, and its greatness. Commercial business is there like a vast lottery, by which a small number of men continually lose, but the state is always a gainer. Such a people ought therefore to encourage and do honor to boldness in commercial speculations. But any bold speculation risks the fortune of the speculator and of all those who put their trust in him. The Americans, who make a virtue of commercial temerity, have no right in any case to brand with disgrace those who practice it. Hence arises the strange indulgence which is shown to bankrupts in the United States. Their honor does not suffer by such an accident. In this respect, the Americans differ, not only from the nations of Europe, but from all the commercial nations of our time, and accordingly they resemble none of them in their position or their wants. In America, all those vices which tend to impair the purity of morals and to destroy the conjugal tie are treated with the degree of severity which is unknown in the rest of the world. At first sight, this seems strangely at variance with the tolerance shown there on other subjects, and one is surprised to meet with a morality so relaxed and so austere amongst the selfsame people. But these things are less incoherent than they seem to be. Public opinion in the United States very gently represses that love of wealth which promotes the commercial greatness and the prosperity of the nation, and it especially condemns that laxity of morals which diverts the human mind from the pursuit of well-being and disturbs the internal order of domestic life, which is so necessary to success in business. To earn the esteem of their countrymen, the Americans are therefore constrained to adapt themselves to orderly habits, and it may be said in this case that they make it a matter of honor to live chastely. On one point, American honor accords with the notions of honor acknowledged in Europe. It places courage as the highest virtue and treats it as the greatest of the moral necessities of man. But the notion of courage itself assumes a different aspect. In the United States, martial valor is but little prized. The courage which is best known and most esteemed is that which emboldens men to brave the dangers of the ocean in order to arrive earlier in port, to support the privations of the wilderness without complaint and solitude more cruel than privations. The courage which renders them almost insensible to the loss of a fortune laboriously acquired, and instantly prompts to fresh exertions to make another. Courage of this kind is peculiarly necessary to the maintenance and prosperity of the American communities, and it is held by them in peculiar honor and estimation. To betray a want of it is to incur certain disgrace. I have yet another characteristic point which may serve to place the idea of this chapter in stronger relief. In a democratic society like that of the United States, where fortunes are scanty and insecure, everybody works, and work opens a way to everything. This has changed the point of honor quite round, and has turned it against idleness. I have sometimes met in America with young men of wealth, personally disinclined to all laborious exertion, but who had been compelled to embrace a profession. Their disposition and their fortune allowed them to remain without employment. Public opinion forbade it, too imperiously to be disobeyed. In the European countries, on the contrary, where aristocracy is still struggling with the flood which overwhelms it, I have often seen men, constantly spurred on by their wants and desires, remain in idleness in order not to lose the esteem of their equals. And I have known them submit to ennui and privations rather than to work. No one can fail to perceive that these opposite obligations are two different rules of conduct, both nevertheless originating in the notion of honor. What our forefathers designated as honor absolutely was in reality only one of its forms. They gave a generic name to what was only a species. Honor, therefore, is to be found in democratic as well as aristocratic ages, but it will not be difficult to show that it assumes a different aspect in the former. Not only are its injunctions different, but we shall shortly see that they are less numerous, less precise, and that its dictates are less rigorously obeyed. The position of a caste is always much more peculiar than that of a people. Nothing is so much out of the way of the world as a small community invariably composed of the same families, as was, for instance, the aristocracy of the Middle Ages, whose object is to concentrate and to retain, exclusively and hereditarily, education, wealth, and power amongst its own members. But the more out of the way the position of a community happens to be, the more numerous are its special wants, and the more extensive are its notions of honor corresponding to those wants. The rules of honor will therefore always be less numerous amongst a people not divided into castes than amongst any other. If ever any nations are constituted in which it may be even difficult to find any peculiar classes of society, the notion of honor will be confined to a small number of precepts, which will be more and more in accordance with the moral laws adopted by the mass of mankind. Thus, the laws of honor will be less peculiar and less multifarious amongst a democratic people than in an aristocracy. It will also be more obscure. And this is a necessary consequence of what goes before. For as the distinguishing marks of honor are less numerous and less peculiar, it must often be difficult to distinguish them. To this, other reasons may be added. Amongst the aristocratic nations of the Middle Ages, generation succeeded generation in vain. Each family was like a never-dying, ever-stationary man, and the state of opinions was hardly more changeable than that of conditions. Everyone, then, had always the same objects before his eyes, which he contemplated from the same point. His eyes gradually detected the smallest details, and his discernment could not fail to become in the end clear and accurate. Thus, not only had the men of feudal times very extraordinary opinions in matters of honor, but each of those opinions was present to their minds under a clear and precise form. This can never be the case in America, where all men are in constant motion, and where society, transformed daily by its own operations, changes its opinions together with its wants. In such a country, men have glimpses of the rules of honor, but they have seldom time to fix attention upon them. But even if society were motionless, it would still be difficult to determine the meaning which ought to be attached to the word honor. In the Middle Ages, as each class had its own honor, the same opinion was never received at the same time by a large number of men. And this rendered it impossible to give it a determined and accurate form, which was the more easy, as all those by whom it was received, having a perfectly identical and mostly peculiar position, were naturally disposed to agree upon the points of law which was made for themselves alone. Thus, the code of honor became a complete and detailed system in which everything was anticipated and provided for beforehand, and a fixed and always palpable standard was applied to human actions. Amongst a democratic nation, like the Americans, in which ranks are identified, and the whole of society forms one single mass, composed of elements which are all analogous, though not entirely similar, it is impossible ever to agree beforehand on what shall or shall not be allowed by the laws of honor. Amongst that people, indeed, some national wants do exist which give rise to opinions common to the whole nation on points of honor. But these opinions never occur at the same time, in the same manner, or with the same intensity to the minds of the whole community. The law of honor exists, but it has no organs to promulgate it. The confusion is far greater still in a democratic country like France, where the different classes of which the former fabric of society was composed, being brought together but not yet mingled, import day by day into each other's circles various and sometimes conflicting notions of honor, where every man, at his own will and pleasure, forsakes one portion of his forefathers' creed and retains another. So that, amidst so many arbitrary measures, no common rule can ever be established, and it is almost impossible to predict which actions will be held in honor and which will be thought disgraceful. Such times are wretched, but they are of short duration. As honor amongst democratic nations is imperfectly defined, its influence is of course less powerful, for it is difficult to apply with certainty and firmness a law which is not distinctly known. Public opinion, the natural and supreme interpreter of the laws of honor, not clearly discerning to which side censure or approval ought to lean, can only pronounce a hesitating judgment. Sometimes the opinion of the public may contradict itself. More frequently, it does not act and lets things pass. The weakness of the sense of honor in democracies also arises from several other causes. In aristocratic countries, the same notions of honor are always entertained by only a few persons, always limited in number, often separated from the rest of their fellow citizens. Honor is easily mingled and identified in their minds with the idea of all that distinguishes their own position. It appears to them as the chief characteristic of their own rank. They apply its different rules with all the warmth of personal interest, and they feel, if I may use the expression, a passion for complying with its dictates. This truth is extremely obvious in the old black-letter law books on the subject of trial by battle. The nobles, in their disputes, were bound to use the lance and sword, whereas the villains used only sticks amongst themselves, inasmuch as, to use the words of the old books, villains have no honor. This did not mean, as it may be imagined at the present day, that these people were contemptible, but simply that their actions were not to be judged by the same rules which were applied to the actions of the aristocracy. It is surprising, at first sight, that when the sense of honor is most predominant, its injunctions are usually most strange, so that the further it is removed from common reason, the better it is obeyed, whence it has sometimes been inferred that the laws of honor were strengthened by their own extravagance. The two things indeed originate from the same source, but the one is not derived from the other. Honor becomes fantastical in proportion to the peculiarity of the wants which it denotes, and the paucity of the men by whom those wants are felt. And it is because it denotes wants of this kind that its influence is great. Thus, the notion of honor is not stronger for being fantastical, but it is fantastical and strong from the self-same cause. Further, amongst aristocratic nations, each rank is different, but all ranks are fixed. Every man occupies a place in his own sphere which he cannot relinquish, and he lives there amidst other men who are bound by the same ties. Amongst these nations, no man can either hope or fear to escape being seen. No man is placed so low but that he has a stage of his own, and none can avoid censure or applause by his obscurity. In democratic states, on the contrary, where all the members of the community are mingled in the same crowd and in constant agitation, public opinion has no hold on men. They disappear at every instant and elude its power. Consequently, the dictates of honor will be there less imperious and less stringent. For honor acts solely for the public eye, differing in this respect from mere virtue, which lives upon itself contented with its own approval. If the listener has distinctly apprehended all that goes before, he will understand that there is a close and necessary relation between the inequality of social conditions and what has here been styled honor, a relation which, if I am not mistaken, had not before been clearly pointed out. I shall therefore make one more attempt to illustrate it satisfactorily. Suppose a nation stands apart from the rest of mankind. Independently of certain general wants inherent in the human race, it will also have wants and interests peculiar to itself. Certain opinions of censure or approbation forthwith arise in the community, which are peculiar to itself, and which are styled honor by the members of that community. Now suppose that in this same nation a caste arises, which, in its turn, stands apart from all the other classes, and contracts certain peculiar wants which give rise in their turn to special opinions. The honor of this caste, composed of a medley of the peculiar notions of the nation and the still more peculiar notions of the caste, will be as remote as it is possible to conceive from the simple and general opinions of men. Having reached this extreme point of the argument, I now return. When ranks are commingled and privileges abolished, the men of whom a nation is composed being once more equal and alike, their interests and wants become identical, and all the peculiar notions which each caste styled honor successively disappear. The notion of honor no longer proceeds from any other source than the wants peculiar to the nation at large, and it denotes the individual character of that nation to the world. Lastly, if it be allowable to suppose that all the races of mankind should be commingled, and that all the peoples of earth should ultimately come to have the same interests, the same wants, undistinguished from each other by any characteristic peculiarities, no conventional value whatever would be attached to men's actions. They would all be regarded by all in the same light. The general necessities of mankind revealed by conscience to every man would become the common standard. The simple and general notions of right and wrong only would then be recognized in the world, to which, by a natural and necessary tie, the idea of censure or approbation would be attached. Thus, to compromise all my meaning in a single proposition, the dissimilarities and inequalities of men give rise to the notion of honor. That notion is weakened in proportion as these differences are obliterated, and with them it would disappear. Chapter 19. Why so many ambitious men and so little lofty ambition are to be found in the United States. The first thing which strikes a traveler in the United States is the innumerable multitude of those who seek to throw off their original condition. And the second is the rarity of lofty ambition to be observed in the midst of the universally ambitious stir of society. No Americans are devoid of a yearning desire to rise, but hardly any appear to entertain hopes of great magnitude or to drive at very lofty aims. All are constantly seeking to acquire property, power, and reputation. Few contemplate these things upon a great scale. And this is the more surprising, as nothing is to be discerned in the manners or laws of America to limit desire or to prevent it from spreading its impulses in every direction. It seems difficult to attribute this singular state of things to the equality of social conditions, for at the instant when that same equality was established in France, the flight of ambition became unbounded. Nevertheless, I think that the principal cause which may be assigned to this fact is to be found in the social condition and democratic manners of the Americans. All revolutions enlarge the ambition of men. This proposition is more peculiarly true of those revolutions which overthrow an aristocracy. When the former barriers which kept back the multitude from fame and power are suddenly thrown down, a violent and universal rise takes place towards that eminence so long coveted and at length to be enjoyed. In this first burst of triumph, nothing seems impossible to anyone. Not only are desires boundless, but the power of satisfying them seems almost boundless too. Amidst the general and sudden renewal of laws and customs, in this vast confusion of all men and all ordinances, the various members of the community rise and sink again with excessive rapidity, and power passes so quickly from hand to hand that none need despair of catching it in turn. It must be recollected, moreover, that the people who destroy an aristocracy have lived under its laws. They have witnessed its splendor, and they have unconsciously imbibed the feelings and notions which it entertained. Thus, at the moment when an aristocracy is dissolved, its spirit still pervades the mass of the community, and its tendencies are retained long after it has been defeated. Ambition is therefore always extremely great as long as a democratic revolution lasts, and it will remain so for some time after the revolution is consummated. The reminiscence of the extraordinary events which men have witnessed is not obliterated from their memory in a day. The passions which a revolution has roused do not disappear at its close. A sense of instability remains in the midst of re-established order. A notion of easy success survives the strange vicissitudes which gave it birth. Desires still remain extremely enlarged when the means of satisfying them are diminished day by day. The taste for large fortunes subsists, though large fortunes are rare. and on every side we trace the ravages of inordinate and hapless ambition kindled in the hearts which they consume in secret and in vain. At length, however, the last vestiges of the struggle are effaced. The remains of aristocracy completely disappear. The great events by which its fall was attended are forgotten. Peace succeeds to war, and the sway of order is restored in the new realm. Desires are again adapted to the means by which they may be fulfilled. The wants, the opinions, and the feelings of men cohere once more. The level of the community is permanently determined, and democratic society is established. A democratic nation, arrived at this permanent and regular state of things, will present a very different spectacle from that which we have just described. And we may readily conclude that, if ambition becomes great whilst the conditions of society are growing equal, it loses that quality when they have grown so. As wealth is subdivided and knowledge diffused, no one is entirely destitute of education or of property. The privileges and disqualifications of caste being abolished, and men having shattered the bonds which held them fixed, the notion of advancement suggests itself to every mind, the desire to rise swells in every heart, and all men want to mount above their station. Ambition is the universal feeling. But if the equality of conditions gives some resources to all the members of the community, it also prevents any of them from having resources of great extent, which necessarily circumscribes their desires within somewhat narrow limits. Thus, amongst democratic nations, ambition is ardent and continual, but its aim is not habitually lofty, and life is generally spent in eagerly coveting small objects which are within reach. What chiefly diverts the men of democracies from lofty ambition is not the scantiness of their fortunes, but the vehemence of the exertions they daily make to improve them. They strain their faculties to the utmost to achieve paltry results, and this cannot fail speedily to limit their discernment and to circumscribe their powers. They might be much poorer and still be greater. The small number of opulent citizens who are to be found amidst a democracy do not constitute an exception to this rule. A man who raises himself by degrees to wealth and power contracts, in the course of this protracted labor, habits of prudence and restraint which he cannot afterwards shake off. A man cannot enlarge his mind as he would his house. The same observation is applicable to the sons of such a man. They are born, it is true, in a lofty position, but their parents were humble. They have grown up amidst feelings and notions which they cannot afterwards easily get rid of, and it may be presumed that they will inherit the propensities of their father, as well as his wealth. It may happen, on the contrary, that the poorest scion of a powerful aristocracy may display vast ambition, because the traditional opinions of his race and the general spirit of his order still buoy him up for some time above his fortune. Another thing which prevents the men of democratic periods from easily indulging in the pursuit of lofty objects is the lapse of time which they foresee must take place before they can be ready to approach them. "It is a great advantage," says Pascal, "to be a man of quality, since it brings one man as forward at 18 or 20 as another man would be at 50, which is a clear gain of 30 years. Those 30 years are commonly wanting to the ambitious characters of democracies. The principle of equality, which allows every man to arrive at everything, prevents all men from rapid advancement. In a democratic society, as well as elsewhere, there are only a certain number of great fortunes to be made, and as the paths which lead them are indiscriminately open to all, the progress of all must necessarily be slackened. As the candidates appear to be nearly alike, and as it is difficult to make a selection without infringing the principle of equality, which is the supreme law of democratic societies, the first idea which suggests itself is to make them all advance at the same rate and submit to the same probation. Thus, in proportion as men become more alike, the principle of equality is more peaceably and deeply infused into the institutions and manners of the country. The rules of advancement become more inflexible, advancement itself slower, the difficulty of arriving quickly at a certain height far greater. From hatred of privilege and from the embarrassment of choosing, all men are at last constrained, whatever may be their standard, to pass the same ordeal. All are indiscriminately subjected to a multitude of petty preliminary exercises, in which their youth is wasted and their imagination quenched, so that they despair of ever fully attaining what is held out to them. And when at length they are in a condition to perform any extraordinary acts, the taste for such things has forsaken them. In China, where the equality of conditions is exceedingly great and very ancient, no man passes from one public office to another without undergoing a probationary trial. This probation occurs afresh at every stage of his career, and the notion is now so rooted in the manners of the people that I remember to have read a Chinese novel in which the hero, after numberless crosses, succeeds at length in touching the heart of his mistress by taking honors. A lofty ambition breathes with difficulty in such an atmosphere. The remark I apply to politics extends to everything. Equality everywhere produces the same effects. Where the laws of a country do not regulate and retard the advancement of men by positive enactment, competition attains the same end. In a well-established democratic community, great and rapid elevation is therefore rare. It forms an exception to the common rule. And it is the singularity of such occurrences that makes men forget how rarely they happen. Men living in democracies ultimately discover these things. They find out, at last, that the laws of their country open a boundless field of action before them, but that no one can hope to hasten across it. Between them and the final object of their desires, they perceive a multitude of small intermediate impediments which must be slowly surmounted. This prospect wearies and discourages their ambition at once. They therefore give up hopes so doubtful and remote to search nearer to themselves for less lofty and more easy enjoyments. Their horizon is not bounded by the laws, but narrowed by themselves. I have remarked that lofty ambitions are more rare in the ages of democracy than in times of aristocracy. I may add that when, in spite of these natural obstacles, they do spring into existence, their character is different. In aristocracies, the career of ambition is often wide, but its boundaries are determined. In democracies, ambition commonly ranges in a narrower field, but if once it gets beyond that, hardly any limits can be assigned to it. As men are individually weak, as they live asunder and in constant motion, as precedents are of little authority and laws but of short duration, resistance to novelty is languid, and the fabric of society never appears perfectly erect or firmly consolidated. So that when once an ambitious man has the power in his grasp, there is nothing he may not dare, and when it is gone from him, he meditates the overthrow of the state to regain it. This gives to great political ambition a character of revolutionary violence, which it seldom exhibits to an equal degree in aristocratic communities. The common aspect of democratic nations will present a great number of small and very rational objects of ambition, from amongst which a few ill-controlled desires of a larger growth will at intervals break out. But no such a thing as ambition conceived and contrived on a vast scale is to be met with here. I have shown elsewhere by what secret influence the principle of equality makes the passion for physical gratifications and the exclusive love of the present predominate in the human heart. These different propensities mingle with the sentiment of ambition and tinge it, as it were, with their hues. I believe that ambitious men in democracies are less engrossed than any others with the interests and the judgment of posterity. The present moment alone engages and absorbs them. They are more apt to complete a number of undertakings with rapidity than to raise lasting monuments of their achievements, and they care much more for success than for fame. What they most ask of men is obedience. What they most covet is empire. Their manners have in almost all cases remained below the height of their station. The consequence is that they frequently carry very low tastes into their extraordinary fortunes, and that they seem to have acquired the supreme power only to minister to their coarse or paltry pleasures. I think that in our time it is very necessary to cleanse, to regulate, and to adapt the feeling of ambition, but that it would be extremely dangerous to seek to impoverish and to repress it overmuch. We should attempt to lay down certain extreme limits, which it should never be allowed to outstep, but its range within those established limits should not be too much checked. I confess that I apprehend much less for democratic society from the boldness than from the mediocrity of desires. What appears to me most to be dreaded is that, in the midst of the small incessant occupations of private life, ambition should lose its vigor and its greatness, that the passions of man should abate, but at the same time be lowered, so that the march of society should every day become more tranquil and less aspiring. I think, then, that the leaders of modern society would be wrong to seek to lull the community by a state of too uniform and too peaceful happiness, and that it is well to expose it from time to time to matters of difficulty and danger, in order to raise ambition and to give it a field of action. Moralists are constantly complaining that the ruling vice of the present time is pride. This is true in one sense, for indeed no one thinks that he is not better than his neighbor, or consents to obey his superior, but it is extremely false in another. For the same man who cannot endure subordination or equality has so contemptible an opinion of himself that he thinks he is only born to indulge in vulgar pleasures. He willingly takes up with low desires without daring to embark in lofty enterprises of which he scarcely dreams. Thus, far from thinking that humility ought to be preached to our contemporaries, I would have endeavors made to give them a more enlarged idea of themselves and of their kind. Humility is unwholesome to them. What they most want is, in my opinion, pride. I would willingly exchange several of our small virtues for this one vice. Chapter 20. The Trade of Place Hunting in Certain Democratic Countries. In the United States, as soon as a man has acquired some education and pecuniary resources, he either endeavors to get rich by commerce or industry, or he buys land in the bush and turns pioneer. All that he asks of the state is not to be disturbed in his toil, and to be secure of his earnings. Amongst the greater part of European nations, when a man begins to feel his strength and to extend his desires, the first thing that occurs to him is to get some public employment. These opposite effects, originating in the same cause, deserve our passing notice. When public employments are few in number, ill-paid and precarious, whilst the different lines of business are numerous and lucrative, it is to business and not to official duties that the new and eager desires engendered by the principle of equality turn from every side. But if, whilst the ranks of society are becoming more equal, the education of the people remains incomplete, or their spirit the reverse of bold, if commerce and industry, checked in their growth, afford only slow and arduous means of making a fortune, the various members of the community, despairing of ameliorating their own condition, rush to the head of the state and demand its assistance. To relieve their own necessities at the cost of the public treasury appears to them to be the easiest and most open, if not the only way they have to rise above a condition which no longer contents them. Place hunting becomes the most generally followed of all trades. This must especially be the case in those great centralized monarchies in which the number of paid offices is immense, and the tenure of them tolerably secure, so that no one despairs of obtaining a place and of enjoying it as undisturbedly as a hereditary fortune. I shall not remark that the universal and inordinate desire for place is a great social evil, that it destroys the spirit of independence in the citizen and diffuses a venal and servile humor throughout the frame of society, that it stifles the manlier virtues, nor shall I be at the pains to demonstrate that this kind of traffic only creates an unproductive activity which agitates the country without adding to its resources. All these things are obvious. But I would observe that a government which encourages this tendency risks its own tranquility and places its very existence in great jeopardy. I am aware that at a time like our own, when the love and respect which formerly clung to authority are seen gradually to decline, it may appear necessary to those in power to lay a closer hold on every man by his own interest, and it may seem convenient to use his own passions to keep him in order and in silence. But this cannot be so long, and what may appear to be a source of strength for a certain time will assuredly become in the end a great cause of embarrassment and weakness. Amongst democratic nations as well as elsewhere, the number of official appointments has in the end some limits, but amongst those nations the number of aspirants is unlimited. It perpetually increases with the gradual and irresistible rise in proportion as social conditions become more equal, and is only checked by the limits of the population. Thus, when public employments afford the only outlet for ambition, the government necessarily meets with a permanent opposition at last. For it is tasked to satisfy with limited means unlimited desires. It is very certain that of all people in the world, the most difficult to restrain and to manage are a people of solicitants. Whatever endeavors are made by rulers, such a people can never be contented. And it is always to be apprehended that they will ultimately overturn the constitution of the country and change the aspect of the state for the sole purpose of making a clearance of places. The sovereigns of the present age, who strive to fix upon themselves alone all those novel desires which are aroused by equality and to satisfy them, will repent in the end, if I am not mistaken, that they ever embarked in this policy. They will one day discover that they have hazarded their own power by making it so necessary, and that the more safe and honest course would have been to teach their subjects the art of providing for themselves. Chapter 21. Why Great Revolutions Will Become More Rare. A people which has existed for centuries under a system of castes and classes can only arrive at a democratic state of society by passing through a long series of more or less critical transformations, accomplished by violent efforts and after numerous vicissitudes, in the course of which property, opinions, and power are rapidly transferred from one hand to another. Even after this great revolution is consummated, the revolutionary habits engendered by it may long be traced, and it will be followed by deep commotion. As all this takes place, at the very time at which social conditions are becoming more equal, it is inferred that some concealed relation and secret tie exist between the principle of equality itself and revolution, insomuch that one cannot exist without giving rise to the other. On this point, reasoning may seem to lead to the same result as experience. Amongst a people whose ranks are nearly equal, no ostensible bond connects men together or keeps them settled in their station. None of them have either a permanent right or power to command. None are forced by their condition to obey. But every man, finding himself possessed of some education and some resources, may choose his one path and proceed apart from all his fellow men. The same causes which make the members of the community independent of each other continually impel them to new and restless desires and constantly spur them onwards. It therefore seems natural that, in a democratic community, men, things, and opinions should be forever changing their form and place, and that democratic ages should be times of rapid and incessant transformation. But is this really the case? Does the equality of social conditions habitually and permanently lead men to revolution? Does that state of society contain some perturbing principle which prevents the community from ever subsiding into calm and disposes the citizens to alter incessantly their laws, their principles, and their manners? I do not believe it. And as the subject is important, I beg for the listener's close attention. Almost all